Dr. Patrice and I have talked about the story of Joseph on several occasions, a story which begins tonight. And in fact, it's a story that spans the parashiyot of the next 4 weeks. Moreover, I should say that Dr. Patrice has even written the drash on this week's portion for the UMJC website in years past, and has taught on it, taught on Joseph in a number of synagogues, including our own. The fact is that the Joseph story is almost as badly misunderstood as the Jacob story, which precedes it. Unfortunately, people tend to read their own perspectives into this story instead of trying to draw out of the text the lessons that are there. Now, in that drash that I mentioned, the written one on the UMJC website, she did a superb job of unwrapping the passage for this week. And I want to build on that and pick up the rest of the Joseph story as well as its lessons for us. Now, back then she wrote, and I quote, "The story of Joseph relates a lengthy and layered story of a man whom many modern readers dislike, at least at first. Joseph, like his father Jacob, is considered despicable." I'm not talking about the Minions. If you didn't get that, sorry. "Both are scolded by modern scholars, theologians, teachers, and clerics for their supposed moral failings and their lack of ethical standards during their earlier years. Both are portrayed in their later lives after long exiles full of suffering as having finally, quote, learned their lesson, end quote, about their earlier misspent youth. In their old age, they are now deemed praiseworthy patriarchs based on their hard-won understanding of all those things that they had done wrong and which resulted in their, quote, changed, end quote, attitudes. Except, did they really fail in their dealings with others at the beginning of their stories? Were both father and son guilty of all the youthful indiscretions they are commonly accused of? Not necessarily. Many of these youthful indiscretions are supplied by the interpreters of the text in question and are not based on actual information that we are given in the Hebrew text. Looking at Jacob's and Joseph's lives based only on the words that are actually in the text can bring a different picture, not only to the lives of these great men of God, but also to our own." End quote. Now, in this particular drash that I've quoted from, Patrice focused on the early part of the story as it was read for you. I want that to look, you know, I want to hop in just a little later to fill out the story just a bit. In the portions upcoming, we'll get to the place where the final curtain is descending on Jacob's life. And as it does, one agonizing question remains. Why didn't Joseph contact his mourning and aged father during the 22 years he spent in Egypt? Now, why did I hop to the end like I just did? Because part of the grief that Joseph gets is not just for the beginning of the story, but for later on in the story. So I want to bring all that grief together, so to speak. So, if it wasn't possible for him to contact his father during the first years of his time in Egypt, when he was in prison or was a household servant, why didn't he make some effort to send word after he'd become the grand prime minister of Egypt? He might have at least dispatched a messenger to check on Jacob's welfare. Or, when his brothers arrived in Egypt the first time to purchase food, he could have informed his father through them that he was alive and prospering. How do we account for Joseph's silence in the face of his father's suffering? In the 13th century, there was a very important rabbi in our traditions, the Ramban Nachmanides, one of my favorites, by the way. He provides an explanation, one which also attempts to make more sense for the various ploys and ruses Joseph uses. Thank you for some of you picking up on that. I appreciate that anytime. that he uses with regard to his brothers. When the brothers first appear in Egypt, the Torah records this for us, chapter 42. And this is critical to understand the story. Remember, you read what's in the text. And Joseph remembered his dreams. Okay? He remembered his dreams. That becomes critical for understanding the rest of the story. The dreams he had dreamed concerning them, and so he said to them, "You are spies." Now, the Ramban suggests that Joseph did not reveal himself to his father or his brothers because he wanted to wait until the 11 stars, all his brothers, in harmony together with the sun, his father, would accept his leadership in accordance with the dream, not that he had, but that God gave him. So he had to evaluate the responses and the character of his brothers at this point in time. In other words, was this the right time to say something? Or to reflect on it a little differently, was this God's timing? But such behavior on his part, many have suggested, and you can understand, this hardly reflects the forgiveness and the sensitivity we might ordinarily expect from someone who is viewed as a paragon of piety. The various tricks he practices on his brothers and the unnecessary pain he inflicts on his father as a result of his silence can hardly be justified by a commitment to the details of God's revelation through a dream. However, in order to truly understand the meaning of the biblical text, it is important to bear in mind the profound jealousy the brothers had harbored toward Joseph. After all, they had placed him in a pit filled with snakes and scorpions. And they sold him to a foreign country as a slave in order to get rid of him forever and as quickly as possible. And before selling him, remember the story, they had seriously discussed killing him. For all Joseph knew, they still wished him dead, or even worse. They had transferred their evil designs to Benjamin, the other son of Rachel. So, if Joseph revealed himself to his father, and therefore to his brothers, before he had an opportunity to properly test or evaluate their character, attitudes, and remorse, an even greater tragedy might well have ensued. Possible scenarios could go something like this. Jacob would condemn the sons for having deceived him about Joseph. The brothers, in self-justification, would then condemn Jacob for having supposedly deceived his own father Isaac, as well as for his uncalled-for favoritism towards Joseph, which had caused the jealousy to flourish in the first place. And maybe they might even have harmed Benjamin. So, a hopelessly divided family would then have come to Egypt with Jacob. Joseph, perhaps this time together with Benjamin, would then have to face the sneering accusations and continuing anger of his brothers, who would now be even more jealous than ever. Look, we should remember that the message of the dream God gave to Joseph had been that his brothers, together with his father, would accept Joseph's leadership. It was a dream of unity and harmony. Therefore, Joseph understands that he can reveal himself to his father and bring his entire family to Egypt only after he is certain that the brothers have truly repented and learned their lesson, that their hatred and their rage, which caused him to be tossed into a pit, that hatred and rage would not reappear and so disrupt God's purpose. From this perspective, all of Joseph's actions now become understandable. Notice what happens. He initially charges his brothers with spying and so imprisons them. After all, they had called him a spy and had imprisoned him in a pit. He then makes them return to Jacob without one of their brothers, Shimon, as they had done when they returned to Jacob without Joseph initially. And then he requests that they bring back Benjamin. Now, as Joseph had suspected, the brothers make the connection between the threat to Benjamin's life, in other words, another favorite son of the same mother, they make the connection between the threat to Benjamin's life and their own previous threat to Joseph's life, which is why they then unexpectedly confess their previous guilt, chapter 42, verse 21, but we are guilty because of our brother Joseph, whose distress we saw when he entreated us, and we did not listen. Now, Joseph knows that they have repented in theory. In other words, there's guilt, perhaps even remorse here. But he's not yet sure that they've truly learned their lesson, that they really have changed their attitude or their animosity. Therefore, listen to what he does. He initially treats Benjamin with favoritism. Sound familiar? But then he charges them all with thievery, insisting that Benjamin remain behind as his slave. They had turned Joseph into a slave. Would they now allow his brother to become one? Is the question that's hanging out there. Will the brothers jump at this opportunity to save their own skins while getting rid of the remaining favorite son of Rachel? Or will they act differently this time? When Judah, the very brother who had sold Joseph into slavery 22 years earlier, when Judah offers himself as a slave instead of Benjamin, Joseph then knows that his brothers have truly repented, and the text says, and he weeps. Only now is he ready to reveal himself to his father so that the dream can come true, for only now is he certain that his forgiveness will in fact bring about unity and reconciliation, not further division. So as the text tells us quite clearly, Joseph too is an appropriate heir of Abraham. And as the rabbis come to understand, he becomes a model for the Messiah. And so later, he appropriately dies with the covenant promises on his mouth. He says, when you get back as God promised, make sure you take me with you. By the way, ascribing arrogance to Joseph is strongly opposed by the rabbinic tradition that observes that despite his power, Joseph retained his sense of humility. In one of the earlier The Midrashim are rabbinic texts that unwrap, often in a narrative kind of fashion, the stories and texts of Scripture. Okay? Having observed that, the Midrash observes that the rabbis claim that Joseph thought of himself as the least of the sons, both when he was a slave and also when he had ascended to power in Egypt. Furthermore, the rabbis of old give Joseph the superlative title of Yosef HaTzadik. In our parlance, we might say Joe the Saint. Thank you. And some of you know some Joes who are definitely not saints, so we won't go there. A significant rabbi of a previous generation described... Well, hold on. Before that, let me fill this in just a little further. Whether this characteristic is for resisting Potiphar's wife, or for crediting God for his ability to interpret dreams, or for his rescue plan for Egypt and his great concern for the physical and psychological welfare of his family, in all these ways, Joseph earned the respect of the rabbis. Yosef HaTzadik. And then there's another point of admiration for Joseph. In all his great deeds, listen to this, he acts alone, which is why the great rabbi from the last generation, Soloveitchik, said, we described him as a lonely man of faith. Think about that. A lonely man of faith. See, as you reflect on the story, with whom can he appropriately share his faith in God, or take counsel, or get support or encouragement? With the brothers who had tried to murder him and then sold him into slavery? with his wife, the daughter of the priest of On, the god of Egypt, one of the gods of Egypt, with Pharaoh. Yet, for all of his isolation, Joseph is never shaken from his enduring faith. His enduring faith in God. Even when things took a number of wrong turns, as Jenny so appropriately reminded us of. Nor would it shake him from his dedication to moral conduct. Joseph does not hear from God in the same way as his ancestors did. His knowledge of God is the product of dreams and introspection. So it is not family, society, or even prophecy that establishes Joseph as a servant of God. He himself must develop what we would call his religious persona on his own. And in this, he's both extraordinary and imitatable. Looking back through scriptures, it seems that most of God's greatest displays of power stem from humble beginnings, just like Joseph in this story. Interestingly enough, we told some of this story last night in the class for the seminary in Yeshiva. So yes, this is commercial time to get some of these wonderful stories before we unwrap them here on a Friday night. Take a class or two. Enough of the commercial. This Torah portion, which always occurs just before Hanukkah, speaks of this concept as well, the concept of God displays his power from humble beginnings. Joseph, remember, was sold as a slave, then jailed for a crime he did not commit. In time, he would rise to the second most powerful position in Egypt and would save his family. Those were humble beginnings. And those kind of humble beginnings reminded us not to lose faith, as Jenny talked about it tonight, even in difficult circumstances. It reminded us of some of the things we've looked at over the last couple weeks. The faith of our forefathers and our foremothers, remember? Faith involves trusting God in and through his trials. Faith involves trusting God when we can't trace him or track him. And then a couple weeks ago we looked at against all hope. Remember, we're supposed to thank God in each and every situation. We are to thank God for everything. Because thanking God expresses trust. So my suggestion is to hop on the trust train. The engine is truth. The engine is fueled by trust. And then we just, pardon me for changing the metaphor, we just truck along. That's part of the story that's going on here. Don't lose faith. And yet, very appropriately for the reading at this particular time in our calendar, the story of Joseph and Hanukkah both have been viewed by our sages of old as picturing the Messiah and his era. So appropriately, they coincide on the calendar. And it is from the story of Joseph that the ancient rabbis, our sages, first began to call the Messiah who would come Ephraim, our righteousness, or the parallel phrase, Messiah, Ben Yosef, Messiah, son of Joseph. Why? Who is Ephraim? Oh, quickly. Thank you, son of Joseph. Okay. So Ephraim, our righteousness, Messiah, Ben Yosef. Now, they say that this Messiah would not be esteemed or recognized by the world, but would rather be despised. But rather would be despised. That's why during Hanukkah, the story of Joseph is so appropriate. It speaks of a rescuer, a liberator, and of his humiliation, as, in fact, was the situation of the Jewish people during the time of the original Hanukkah. And that was their situation until a rescuer or a deliverer came following that very picture of Joseph that we have in our text. Let me just take a quick aside and elaborate on that, as our sages of old, the rabbis, did. In a later midrash, The rabbis tell us that the Messianic era was to be associated with the Feast of Hanukkah as a time, here's how they describe it, when Israel would bask in the light of the Messiah. Basking in the light, is that, can you see some of the connection they're driving for? And by the way, given that as part of the background, no wonder Levi in his Gospel, Matthew chapter 2, verse 2, has the Magi, who were probably Jews, but that's another story. He has the Magi ask about his star, the light. The light that the very name of our synagogue reminds us of in the daily prayers. O God, Or Chadash, cause a new light to shine on us. May we be worthy to experience its splendor. Or in the abridged Amidah that we do from time to time. May we get to see the lengthening of the light of the Messiah. So the connection is there. A further connection between light and the Messiah is found in the Midrashic comments of our sages on Isaiah 61, verse 10. Commenting, they say the following. The text teaches that the Holy One, blessed be He, will place on Ephraim, our true Messiah, son of Joseph, remember, a garment, one the son of Joseph, a garment whose splendor will scream forth from world's end to world's end. Garment? A magnificent garment? A coat of many colors? Okay. And Israel will make use of the light of the Messiah. You know, that reminds us, or should remind us, because light is connected to Hanukkah by the rabbis, not only of Hanukkah, but Shabbat. Because during Lechad Odi, we sing right around verse 4 or 5, arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord rises on you. That's Isaiah chapter 60, verse 1, which goes on a couple verses to say this, arise, shine, your light has come, the glory of the Lord rises on you. Now listen to how that's followed. Nations will come to your light, picture this, and kings, or noble people, to the brightness of your dawn. Camels will cover your land. Young camels will come bearing gold and incense and proclaiming the praise of the Lord. Does that picture sound familiar at all? Anyhow, the text I departed from the Midrash, and it goes on to say, and Israel will make use of the light of the Messiah and will say, in a Hanukkah setting, blessed is the hour in which he was born, Mashiach ben Yosef, son of Joseph. Blessed is the womb from which he came. Blessed is the eye which merits seeing him, shepherds, magi, Chana, Simeon. The one who brings pardon and forgiveness for Israel. Well noted, Levi, Matthew chapter 1, verse 21. He will be called Yeshua. Why? Because he will bring pardon and forgiveness for Israel. Well, a brief aside back to the original Joseph story. So, what should we think about Joseph? His older brothers were jealous of Joseph's status as the favorite with their father. That jealousy was so evil and powerful that it almost resulted in a murder. But instead, was used as a pretext to get rid of Joseph and his dreams. Sending Joseph into exile, however, led directly to the liberation of his family many years later. The young man who left his homeland as a slave rose to the highest administrative position in the land of exile, in his land of exile. And then he used his power to rescue his family instead of turning his back on them in their time of need, as they may well have deserved. And so as an older man, Joseph won the respect of his entire... Wait a second. As an older man? How old was he when the story began? How many years was he in Egypt before they showed up? 22. How old was he? No, how old was he now? 30. Gosh, he was an old man, wasn't he? I should be so old. Where was I? When he was an older man, Joseph won the respect of his whole family when he took care of them during the famine in Canaan. He provided them with more than they could have expected. And he reminded them and us of something he understood throughout his life, which Jenny also pointed out. Thank you for the points that you made in preparation for this. What you intended for evil, God turned into good. So when we face Joseph-like experiences, let's remember Joseph's take. And please remember where we found him when we left him in the reading. I'm not going to ask if any of you have ever found yourself in the same kind of situation, namely in prison. I'm not going to ask that. But when we're in prison-like situations, let's remember the lesson that he derived. What looks like is evil, God can turn into good. He turns curses into blessings. So Joseph is a perfect example of someone we should admire, not criticize. Now, let me conclude with quoting the conclusion to Dr. Patrice's drash from several years ago. Genesis 37:11 says that Jacob, after initially being upset with Joseph's dream, kept the matter in mind. Many years later, Miriam, mother of another gifted young teenager with special insight, also kept these matters, this time about Yeshua, in her mind, her heart, Luke 2:51. Her husband, also named Joseph, was guided by God through his dreams, which provided his family with unity and safety. The gospel writers clearly recognized Yeshua's deep ties with his ancestor Joseph, from the very beginning of his story, end quote. And so, we can say, he is truly Ben Yosef, son of Joseph, or Mashiach Ben Yosef, on more than one count. And as such, we take to heart the words. He's the God who turns curses into blessings. Which bad things are you facing now that you're expecting God to turn into blessings? Well, that's a nosy question. And with that, I'll close. Take the next minute of quiet to reflect on the answer to that question or the possible answer to similar questions at future times when things may look somewhat bleak.